The Community Character Hour is brought to you in part by the generous support of Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. Thanks to Lori, Clem, and all of you for supporting community radio in North Idaho. Tuned into the Community Character Hour, we begin each program with a historical newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah?
All right. Today's article comes from the Pondere Review on November 18th, 1913. It wasn't a turkey trot, but a turkey walk Tuesday morning when a carload of turkeys were driven from the Northern Pacific Depot to the Bonner Meat Market. The turkeys drove all right until they got to the rear of the market when they began roosting high. It was comical to watch one after another fly up on top of the shed at the rear of the market, and one venturesome old gobbler flew up to the top of the Idaho Furniture Building and looked down the chimney. The drove were finally herded and were speedily made into dressed fowls for the Keno games.
Very, yes, seasonally appropriate for this time of year. Where did that take place?
This was at the Bonner Meat Market.
Which, do we know where that was?
Yes, I believe it was, there were a bunch of meat markets, but I think Bonner Meat was in the building where We Yoga is now, on the corner of First and Pine Street.
I used to live in that building, Hannah.
Well, you probably have some ghosts in there.
Ghosts of turkeys in there. Okay. This is the Community Character Hour you're listening to on 88.5 KRFY, Panhandle Community Radio. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm here, as always, with Hannah Combs, the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. Heather Upton out today, but that's all right. We're talking, as we always do, about local history and local character, and we're talking today with Stan Myers. He's a local historian, and our subject today, we can talk about turkeys before we get too deep into it, but our subject today will be borders, defining the borders of the Idaho Panhandle. How did it come to be that this place exists in the way that it exists today? We are, first of all, anything further to say about the turkeys that they found? I'm guessing these would be the wild turkeys that we still see around.
Well, that's a good question. It does say they were delivered by train, so that makes me think they likely were farmed turkeys, or maybe there was a great turkey hunt somewhere and they gathered them all up.
Yes.
And sent them.
Okay. So
that way.
Tastier. I've heard that the local wild turkeys don't make for great eating.
I have also heard that. Yeah. Probably good dog food though.
Let's see, Stan. Let's introduce you to the listeners. You are what makes you particularly interested? I guess in the you just finished giving a talk earlier. Last week was it about the borders were surveyed around here?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's right.
And what makes you interested in this, or what's kind of your general area of interest as far as local history goes?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Jack. So, geez, about 3 years ago, I started a book about the history of the Clark Fork area, sort of eastern Bonner County, and one of the topics is the borders, because it's close to Clark Fork, the eastern border, and I was thinking about two things. One was, when we were in school, a big myth that had been told for decades to Idaho school kids in their Idaho history classes was that the eastern border had been surveyed from south to north, and that somewhere along the line, halfway up, the surveyors got lost in the fog or were drunk and lost, and off they went to the northwest instead of the northeast, following the Bitterroot Divide instead of the Continental Divide. And they got to south of Clark Fork, found the Clark Fork River cutting across their Continental Divide, which is impossible. Realized they'd made a big mistake and turned a point and ran straight to the border.
That's the myth.
That's the myth, and that's entirely untrue. And, and then I got it. And then later in 1985, I was at University of Idaho, and I discovered a paper that was written in 1899 of an assistant packer on the straight line border survey east of Clark Fork. And it was 10 pages, and it was a paper stuck into a volume of hardcore geology papers. And it was in there because the editor was a friend of the son of the guy that wrote this thing. And I found this thing that was really cool, and I held on to it for all these years. 3 years ago, I was reading that paper again and researched and thought, there's a really cool story here that most people don't know. And one thing led to another, and I began the book project. And so this will be this border story in the Panhandle is just one chapter in that book. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I got into this, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. One chapter in a still forthcoming book.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. It's still forthcoming, and I'm cranking along. It's been 2 years, and I'm getting there. Maybe I'm three quarters of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're lucky to have Stan come and visit us at the museum frequently to dive into our archives and look for more little nuggets and details for his book.
So should we talk about it? That's the myth. Would you like to talk about what the true story is first, or should we talk about how that myth kind of came to be? Why did people think it was, this kind of false narrative?
Well, the last one I can address pretty quickly. It's just because that shape of Idaho out narrows so much to the north. And then on Lost Trail Pass, which is on the highway between Darby, Montana and Salmon, Idaho, the Continental Divide, which the surveyors according to the myth, were supposed to follow, gets very, very subtle. It's rounded mountains covered in thick pines, and the Bitter Divide, which is real bold, sticks up like a Continental Divide is supposed to look like. that's sort of how it originated, I believe. And I believe that for years. And I brought that up actually in one of my classes at the University of Idaho, and I was belittled by the professor for believing such a silly story.
Oh, no.
That's how I first learned it wasn't the true story. But yeah, if you'd like, I can begin on the factual stuff. Okay, so this will be about how the two straight lines of our panhandle came to be, and the top line, and then how the two lines were surveyed, which were just heroic efforts, straight lines over mountains, of course, being difficult to get through. So we have to go back and understand how the territory of Idaho was formed. And before 1860, Idaho was just at the part of the Rocky Mountains. The people were coming across on the Oregon Trail, coming from east to west, and it was just a barrier to get across. Nobody really wanted to settle in a place called Idaho. It was just big mountains and high deserts and Indians who didn't appreciate the people crossing their lands, and they wanted to just survive. However, in the Pacific Northwest, there were four countries that had interest in the region for different reasons. Russia, Spain, Great Britain, and the United States. Mm-hmm. And the United States signed the treaty with Spain, who controlled Mexico, to limit their northernmost extents at the 42nd parallel, which for reference is the southern border of Idaho today.
So
and that was the northernmost extent of Mexico at the time, or Alto, California. Mm-hmm. In 1824, the United States signed a treaty with Russia, who controlled Alaska, to limit their southern claims at the latitude 54 degrees 40 minutes north, which is about halfway up into British Columbia. So at that point, it was just Great Britain and the United States. Why did they both want to stay in the Pacific Northwest? Well, they liked the coast because of safe harbors for their ships. Mm-hmm. But it was all about the beaver, beaver fur, and top hats were made out of beaver fur, and that was the rage until about 1840 or so.
Was that the rage here in the United States, or where were they sending?
All over the world.
Okay.
If you were a distinguished gentleman or wanted to be one, you had to have a top hat made of processed beaver fur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I told at the museum, if you want to know one quirky tidbit about beaver fur, one square inch of beaver fur has about the same amount of hair as an entire human head. And that's why it's so dense. That's why it was made into top hats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was all about the beavers and trapping. And that's what brought David Thompson from Canada to the south in the Lake Pend'Oreille in 1809. He was with the Northwest Company, a British company. They were followed by the Hudson's Bay Company. There were American fur companies. The free trappers, the mountain men of the American West, were trapping the beaver. They were all competing for this. And in 1845, a man was running for president named James Polk, and he liked war, and he wanted the Southwest, and he wanted the Northwest, and he declared in his run-up that he was going to go to war with Mexico over the Southwest and Great Britain over the Northwest. And he was elected, and we went to war with Mexico in the Southwest. And but he decided that two wars were too expensive to fight, and he negotiated. Mm-hmm. And in 1846, the Treaty of Oregon was signed, which mm-hmm. created the 49th parallel across the western United States between the United States and Canada. And that was our top line of our panhandle that was coming. Okay, so we got that. We acquired that.
So that's our national border.
The international border.
Still
it had been already decided to the Continental Divide, mm-hmm. and it was just a matter of getting it across to the Pacific Ocean. So
okay.
we extended that 49th parallel. Mm-hmm. And you maybe skied at 49 degrees north, which is south of that, but that's where that comes from.
And at this point, was that a theoretical border, or did they actually survey it at that point?
They surveyed that later.
Okay.
And that was a heroic effort. It was a border commission, and there's a huge story in the 1870s to 1880 of both countries had to survey and cut that line that you see today, and that there's a whole story in itself.
Okay, so
in 1846 we had that line. In 1848 the Oregon Territory was created, and that was the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, parts of Wyoming and Montana. And that was our first territory. However, it was still all about being on the West Coast. And it all changed in 1860 when Elias Pierce discovered gold in what was to become Pierce, Idaho, north central Idaho, north of Orofino, and triggered a whole series of gold rushes across Idaho and Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fighting a civil war at the time, just a few years after that, and the Union Army was in great debt and wanted that gold to help pay for the war debts, and they didn't want that gold to go into the South. And they created what was called a mining commonwealth, which was Idaho Territory in 1863, right in the middle of the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln signed that law, and that was Idaho, all of Idaho, present-day Idaho, Montana, and almost all of Wyoming. Okay, that was the largest territory at the time, and it was just created to secure that gold.
Was it split off from Washington and Oregon at this point?
That's right.
Okay.
It was. And so that territory, so that act on, March 3rd, 1863, created our western panhandle line, okay? And that's the straight line that we have today as the western panhandle line. That line starts right at about between Lewiston and Clarkston, Idaho. And the reason that occurred is because the state of Oregon was admitted to the Union in 1859,
mm-hmm.
and that northeast corner of Oregon was set at the Snake River because there was a straight line on the east side of Oregon and it followed the Snake River, which flows north and south. And Congress likes straight lines or rivers that follow straight lines.
Mm-hmm.
They took off from that endpoint, followed the Snake River to where it turns at Lewiston and flows to the west, and then ran the line straight to what they call the British Possessions, straight to the north, and that was 177 miles.
Wow. Okay.
So that created that line. Okay.
Hmm.
Okay. So Idaho Territory was still huge. The capital was in Lewiston. There have been gold discoveries made around Boise and especially in Montana, Bannock City and some other places. And all those three cities were competing for the people and the power and to be the capital. Lewiston didn't want to lose control of the capital. But it was clear that the territory was too big to govern. People couldn't travel across it for 8 months of the year because of the mountains and things. And while Lewiston was completely consumed with the loss of power to Boise because the gold discoveries in northern Idaho had been played out and the gold discoveries around Boise were becoming really big and people had shifted.
So did we have like a boom bust kind of situation up here where they only lasted for a year or two?
Months to years, just a few years. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, they said one of the big booms, Florence, Idaho, which is just south of Grangeville, in a 2 week period, they went from 8,000 people to 2,000 people, with 6,000 people stampeding to Boise to gold strikes there. In any case, while this was happening, the Idaho legislature had gained more power because of all the people to the south and had voted to move the capital.
Oh.
And Lewiston refused to do that. And and I'll come back to that in a second. But that while they were consumed with that, with trying to retain the capital, a contingent from Bannock City, Montana, went east to Washington, D.C. And one of those people had $2,500 worth of Bannock City gold sewn into his jacket to help convince Congress to create a Montana territory that would be at the Bitterroot Valley or Bitterroot Divide versus the Continental Divide. The Idaho legislature had passed a law or a request to Congress to create it at the Continental Divide. That would have made Butte, Montana part of Idaho.
So a lot of mining holdings then.
Yes. And above all else, the miners in Montana wanted to have their own territory and didn't want
to. So the territory we're talking about that at that time existed, at least the political lines had been drawn.
Yes.
They've already separated out the states of Washington and Oregon.
Washington was a territory, Oregon was a state. Yes. Okay. Yep, that's right. It's present shapes.
But the state of Idaho, was a territory and it contained all of Idaho and what?
Montana.
And all of Montana?
And yes, all of Montana and almost all of Wyoming. There was just a small corner of Wyoming that wasn't part of it. It was part of Utah.
Okay. So like a bigger area probably.
Much bigger.
That's right. Yeah, like a huge area.
It was huge. And so people from Bannock City would complain they couldn't get to Lewiston in the wintertime and vice versa. And people in Wyoming couldn't travel across to Lewiston, Idaho, right?
I think in one of our previous episodes, we had already talked about how kind of Washington and Idaho split over a similar kind of thing, like just two very different cultures on different sides of the territory who had different interests and decided they wanted to part ways. And so it sounds like now we're leading up to a similar situation between Idaho and Montana.
Exactly. The Washington-Idaho tension was because the Olympia was the capital of Oregon Territory. I didn't mention that. And they were the coast. And it was the gold miners versus the coast. And the people in Olympia recognized that eastern Washington was a budding agricultural region. They wanted that. They wanted to separate from the miners. And that's how that – and that northeast corner of Oregon was just a convenient spot to run a line – a point to run a line to the north. And the same thing happened between Montana – what was to be Montana and Idaho. The tension between Lewiston and Bannock City. But it was all about the Continental Divide versus the Bitterroot Divide, which is the current divide. And that's the beautiful mountains when you drive from south from Missoula – to Hamilton and Darby, off to your right to the west, the big, beautiful mountains. That's the Bitterroot Divide. People from Idaho wanted the Continental Divide. People from Montana wanted the Bitterroot Divide. That was the big question.
And we're lucky sitting in the studio here to be looking at a map of the United States, which is really helping illustrate this.
Yes.
I encourage, if you have one handy, to pull it up. But looking at that, I mean, this looks difficult because the mountains through Idaho and Montana, outside of maybe Colorado, are really, it looks like the densest part of the Rocky Mountains.
That's right.
United
and
States.
There's no straight lines, of course. The mountain ranges go all over the place, and Congress likes straight lines. And Colorado, Wyoming are straight rectangles. And so nothing really worked between Idaho and Montana. So, however, the Continental Divide would have roughly been sort of a north south line, but not really, but less. But the Bitterroot Divide obviously next way down. And I'd say that it was called the Organic Act of the Montana Territory in 1864. That was passed on May 26, 1864. It defines that border as extending northward from the Continental Divide, which is south of Salmon, Idaho, along the Bitterroot Crest to a meridian, which was the 39th meridian, which was from Washington, D.C. at the time. And then it runs north to the British possessions. It's a 70-mile long line. And I think northern Idaho was especially unknown by anybody. They felt the Bitterroot Divide was convenient and everybody could find that on a map. At that point, there were just no rivers or divides continuing off to the north. And instead of necking it around Lake Pend'Oreille, over to Washington, et cetera, they just ran that line straight to the north at the Clark Fork River.
And real quick, to back up, you mentioned a man going to D.C. with a coat full of gold to petition. Was this the man that you called Squirrel Hunter, or what was his name?
His name was Sidney Edgerton. And the year before 1863, he fought in the Civil War for the Union Army as a squirrel hunter. That was a real title, a real job. Troops had to be fed by something. He had been appointed by Abraham Lincoln to be Idaho Territory's first Chief Justice of our territorial Supreme Court. But he left late in the year from Washington, D.C. and went across the country with his family, and he managed to get as far as Bannock City, Montana, before the passes had closed with the snow, and he spent the winter in Bannock City. And that during that winter, he became completely endeared with the cause of the Montana gold miners, and that that was a better place to be than Lewiston, he thought. And he was the chief architect of that. And it was his jackets that had the $2,500 worth of gold that he went east with and did not return west with. Rumor has it, this was all settled late at night with whiskeys, cigars, and exchange of gold. Who knows? Signing, it was passed by Congress one day, signed into law that night, and without any representatives from Idaho present, except technically Edgerton, who had become a complete Montana convert.
We're talking to Stan Myers, a local historian, about just how the origins of the state of Idaho and the Panhandle in particular, how the borders came to be. And I'm looking at this, and the Panhandle, where we sit right now, is so narrow. Like, did anybody say, like, hey, why don't we just push Montana all the way to the Washington border, or vice versa?
That I don't know, Jack. And I looked into that a bit, and all I know is just that description of the Montana Act, which defines the border where it's at, but I could not find the discussions that must have happened in Congress. However,
that seemed a little too greedy. Did they know how close they were pushing it?
I don't think, actually, a good thing you brought that up, because there's a good story of right after this was passed, one of the senators who had voted for that Montana territory turned to his colleague and asked, where is this place? So no, I don't think they even understood what they were doing or looking at a map. It would been explained to them by Edgerton and his colleagues where this should be, and they basically accepted it.
Yeah. This land had been surveyed at least enough that they knew they were creating roughly this shape, and not, you know, it wasn't like they had to go and discover that, you know, maybe that mountain range could have been 50 or 100 miles east or west.
It's more than 100 miles, yeah. Well, I think if you look, you know, Idaho's the oddball-shaped state in the whole Northwest.
The whole western United States is right angles and square and straight lines.
And rectangles.
Except for the coastline and then our border with Montana.
And I think it was just that, the Idaho-Washington border sort of makes sense because it extended right up north from Oregon's border there. So that's a nice north-south line for the most part.
Yeah.
But it was the eastern border of Idaho, which is the problem, and western border of Montana. And I think it's just because there were not east, north-south river valleys, mountain ranges. They had to go, they had to angle to the northeast or the northwest. And so one side was going to win that battle.
Yeah.
And so we're left with that panhandle. Yeah, if they would have cut across right at Lake Ponderay or the Clark Fork River, Montana would have had a small panhandle on the northwest corner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we ended up with that. And so it's 70.717 miles on the east side, and on the west side, it's 177, I think, 0.8 miles. On
the straight line the straight sections, lines. Yeah.
And we're about 45 miles across. It's about because they're two lines of longitude which converge the North Pole. They're not absolutely parallel, but they're about a mile apart from the north to the south. But it's about 45 miles wide. So that's sort of the story how we ended up with that shape.
Tell me, I think you just explained, but why they followed the bitter root north to a certain point and then just said, now it's going to be a straight line.
That's right. They followed it to the Bitterroot Mountains end, right at the Green Monarchs of Lake Ponderay, and the mountains south of the Clark Fork River at Clark Fork are the northernmost extent of the Bitterroot Mountains, the Coeur d'Alene Mountains are part of the Bitterroots. And so it just ended there. So they had to do something with it at that point. And that was just, and they picked that, and they had that river there. So they just took the line and went straight to the north. And it would be nice. It would be fun to know the conversations and debates they had, but we don't know.
Yeah. Those, you know. Well, so there. I guess there you have it. So then, where does the story pick up from there? Then at that point, the borders of what becomes the state of Idaho have been determined. The borders of Montana were determined. Wyoming as well.
Wyoming, Idaho came a little bit later. There was still Idaho territory extended to the west, or to the east, sorry, into Wyoming. Yeah. It followed the Continental Divide. The Continental Divide had been picked down there.
Sure.
And that came later. I don't remember the year, but it was after 1864. Mm-hmm. That final piece of straight line between Idaho and Wyoming was settled.
Yeah.
So.
And at this, during this period of time, I think the Dakotas were still a territory as well, right? I think the last...
That's right.
Like, Minnesota was the last state, and then it was from that point west, it was...
those were
territories.
Different territories. Yeah. In fact, Idaho Territory is part of the Dakota Territory. North and South Dakota hadn't been separated. They were separated at statehood. There was Dakota Territory, Washington Territory, and I believe it was Utah Territory. It was three territories, or Nebraska Territory, sorry, that encompassed a big part of the Midwest there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So at this point, Congress has drawn lines on a map.
Yes.
But no one has actually been here put anything on the ground.
Lines on a map are easy, aren't they? Getting them on the ground is a whole other story. And that's the sort of the second part of the story is that both lines had to be surveyed and monumented as the regions become settled. And it was not until, 1873, the border between Idaho and Washington was first surveyed. It was with wooden monuments. And in 1908, that line was surveyed again with iron and cement or granite monuments. And that was an amazing, that's one of our stories we know some detail about. The survey crew began at the confluence of the Clearwater and Snake Rivers between Lewiston and Clarkston. They spent a week trying to establish the border was defined at the midpoint of the channel between the two rivers. They spent a week with beer kegs and weights trying to establish a buoy out there before they realized that was a hopeless task.
That sounds like someone, again, like in an office somewhere saying, like, it'll be in the middle of the river, thinking of the people who had to go out in boats to try to set that point.
Exactly. So they finally established a point on the north side of the river, the Snake River, and then ran that line north and went across the modern-day Palouse country. And every mile, they were putting in a 90-pound iron round post, and then every 5 miles, an 800-pound granite monument that was inscribed with Washington on one side, Idaho on the other. And that went well until they got to about Newport, Washington, to the Pend Oreille River.
How did they transport 800-pound granite posts?
They had carts full of mules, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that worked well because they had farm roads and things out across that country. Mm-hmm. But they got to Newport, things changed. They had to cross the New Pend Oreille River with a raft they had to build, and then there was nothing to the north. And this would be the country north of northwest of Priest River, Priest Lake. It was just vast, thick forest. Nobody was living up there except a few Indians who were wandering in the country, trapping and hunting. There was no roads and infrastructure. And they abandoned the effort of putting in the monuments every mile and 5 miles, just packed some posts with them, and tried to get to the international border. And they described at times when the entire crew would be with axes cutting trees to get the pack string through. They had a heck of a time. They had a run-in with a bear, and they ended up eating the bear, but that was held up for a while. And then
What time of year was this?
It was late in the year, very late in the year. And
yikes.
Yes, it was getting cold. Snow was falling. And in fact, they described in the last 5 days of that survey, they had to give up the pack string. They left those in a meadow somewhere. Struck off by foot, and this is cold with lots of snow, like a foot or two of snow. They lived for 5 days on just bags of flour. They ran out of food, sacks of flour. They actually stopped short a mile short of the international border. They couldn't reach it. In fact, they described that people were going to start to die, and they abandoned the whole thing. They came in the next year and finished that mile.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was so that, and they, yeah, and it was just an incredible experience for him getting to that forest. And
yeah,
so now the survey or the west eastern line up north of Clark Fork, the one I mentioned where I found the document in 1985, is pretty cool because we know more details about that one. It was at 10 pages written by an assistant packer who was a student from Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, who had rode a bicycle from Walla Walla to Spokane to apply for the job with the U.S. Geological Survey. Got the job with a friend. They were given train tickets to Heron, Montana, and report there with just the clothes, and the survey would take care of the rest. And so that survey was done in three summer seasons, 1897, 1898, and 1899, okay? Mm-hmm. And the first year, the crew had to decide, because border surveys had to be very exact. Northern Idaho had been surveyed by the railroad, but that was pretty crude. So there was more surveying for homesteaders, but that wasn't good enough for a border survey.
So this was about 10 to 15 years after the first railroad built through the area.
Right.
Okay.
They had surveyed the U.S. land surveyors had surveyed the railroad corridors so homesteaders could apply for homesteads. Mm-hmm. But those surveys weren't accurate enough for a state border. Mm-hmm. The closest monument that they could use was in downtown Spokane, in the front of the courthouse. It was called a latitude pier, and there's a survey point that had been measured from Washington, D.C., and that was, and it's still there. I've yet to see it, but it's supposedly out in front of the federal courthouse, downtown Spokane. They surveyed out of Spokane, and they made a five-mile baseline, and then they started triangulating between mountain peaks. And their goal was to establish the North Point and the South Point that first summer. And they were surveying from mountain peak, triangulating, and they...
Can you explain a little bit about how triangulating works?
Yeah, it's a very accurate way to survey.
How did they determine where they were going off of in Spokane? How did that point get there?
That's right. They had that point that had been in downtown Spokane that had been surveyed from Washington, D.C.
Yeah. How did somebody...
I think they actually used star positions
with
sextants and things and determined that position, but it was defined by degrees west of Washington, D.C., which at the time was our latitudes or longitudes. And that was a very, very precisely defined point.
Uh-huh.
It was the closest they had to do that. So they, with millimeters of accuracy.
Wow.
And so they did, they surveyed out the railroad tracks out of Spokane, Washington for 5 miles until they could get view of some of the mountains between Spokane and northern Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do, triangulating involves setting up points on two mountaintops. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they had to survey up to those two points, a very top. Now they have no maps, right? So they begin with nothing. So they can put those two points on the ground. They determine with star positions where they're at on the face of the earth, but they have to put those two points on a map. Mm-hmm. Then they're on a third point, and they use a transit, and either with a person up there with a rod or a very precise monument, and survey a very precise line, a bearing to those two points, plot those backwards, and where those two lines intersect is your position. If that's done very precisely, it can be super accurate. You don't have to worry about declination and things like that. Okay, so once they establish three points, then they just started working three peaks at a time up until all the way to the eastern border. And some of the peaks that you might recognize that they established on the map were Choco Peak, which is the mountain that south of Silverwood that a lot of people hike to. As they got Blacktail Mountain north of Bayview, Idaho, was surveyed in that survey. There were about 20 peaks. Round Top on top above Hope. Scotchman Peak, which is, of course, famous, was part of that survey. Mm-hmm. Scotchman number 2 was named by this survey, which is about 5 miles to the north. And then on up by Bonner's Ferry, Buckhorn Mountain, which you can see looking off to the northeast from Bonner's Ferry around the Idaho-Montana border, was one of those peaks. So these are peaks that were first put on the map by that survey in 1897.
And they put them on the map, or does somebody actually have to go up to the top of the mountain?
They had to go to every top of each mountain.
Yeah.
And they mentioned that there were a lot of forest fires and they were really hampered by thick smoke.
Ooh. Oh,
they were delayed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they ended up finishing that survey October 31st in 2.5 feet of snow. But they got it done. But I think they were suffering like our guys between Idaho and Washington.
Some of those mountains I don't want to climb for fun. I can't imagine having to climb 8 of them in a row.
Yeah. No roads, no trails.
Smoke. And,
smoke and snow and cold. So the second year, in 1898, they came back in and between those two points just surveyed in the rough line. Now, they called that the random line. We don't know much about that year, that summer, but we do know that the total ups and downs of that line of going up and down was 63,000 feet. And this is so, if you're standing up on Scotchman Peak, that borders about a mile and a half to the east, and then it goes off to the northeast. So it goes across the rugged Cabinet Mountains, and a straight line is a straight line over cliffs and down cliffs and crosses rivers, and they had to follow that line. And then across the Kootenai River and over the Purcell Mountains. And so that's all 63,000 feet. And they finished as well in October with a lot of snow. And that's all we know.
So I'm so curious, who signs up for this? So obviously some people with the U.S. Geological Survey, that's their job. They have to. But these kids were just looking for adventure.
They were looking for adventure. They actually wrote that they saw a newspaper ad by the USGS at Walla Walla, Washington, looking for summer students for these surveys, and preferably kids that had packing experience or surveying experience. And both the guy that wrote this article, Ross Bratton and his friend, both had worked for their friends or fathers as surveyors, and they knew horses.
Uh-huh.
So they rode bicycles from Walla Walla to Spokane to apply for the job, and that would be probably a story in itself, too, in those days. So And the surveyors came from Washington, D.C. They were permanent employees of the USGS. They were known surveyors and cartographers mm-hmm. who were pretty busy at the time putting the United States on maps. And they came out west and then hired – they had axemen to cut the lines. They had packers with pack mules, cooks, all kinds of different people who they hired locally, mm-hmm. people who knew the terrain and knew the areas. And,
yeah. Oh, I'm curious, Stan, are there any photographs of any of these surveys that you've seen?
There are, yes, yes.
Wow.
And there's some good ones. And on the Idaho-Washington border survey, there's some typical surveys of these guys going across the Palouse with carts and putting in the monuments. And then there's a survey when they finished where the guys are just completely worn out. They're on the border, and they look in desperate need of a bunch of time off. And they were cold, hungry, and ready to stop this whole thing. Mm-hmm. On the eastern border, there's lots of survey pictures with Brayton's article, Brayton's 10-page document, and it's pretty cool. So in 1899, they took off from the southern point to survey north, and what they were doing is, and I'll explain the photos in a second. They had to resurvey the line, correct the errors, cut the line out, put in the monuments, and then they made a topographic strip map along the border. There was one guy assigned who was a cartographer who could draw contour lines, and that was his job. And there's a picture of the three, they established three granite monuments, and one of those was on the southernmost point. And because it was up on the Coeur d'Alene Divide, and it's still there, it was sawn in 10 pieces, packed up by five pack mules, one side, it was an 800-pound piece, so each divided by 10, 80 pounds each, two to a mule. And there's a picture mm-hmm. of them reassembling that at the point, re-seaming in that, and establishing that point. And then they marched off northward. They surveyed down the Clark Fork River. Some of the mules almost got swept down Cabinet Gorge. That was before the dam, but they got them across.
Wow.
And they started up up on the Cabinets east of Scotchman Peak, and that's when things changed. And at first sight of the cliffs they had to cross, two of the axemen quit immediately. They had to hire more at Noxon, or Heron, I think. And there's pictures of a guy with a transit hanging off of a cliff out on a snag, because it was line of sight surveying now. Now we're going with a transit from point to point, and they had to follow that line. They weren't putting the monuments every mile because that was way too difficult, but they put those steel or the iron, 90-pound iron post on every ridge that they crossed.
Hmm.
And there's a beautiful picture of the camp at the base of Scotchman in a meadow. This would be in the West Fork of Blue Creek, if you know that area, with the tents and a flag and the mules and then just more pictures to the north of these big slabs of the quartzite, the rock that's really hard and dipping off, tilted off to the east he talks a lot about trying to get the mules across these big slabs. And it was in the late summer, there was still snow melt, there was wet, and the mules kept falling off slipping and falling, and he described
were they shod?
They were, so that made it more difficult. Uh-huh. So they had horseshoes or mule shoes on hard rock that was tilted and very smooth, polished uh-huh. by the glaciers, and it kept falling. And he mentioned once a mule fell, when it would fall again, they could never get it back up. They had to unload the packs and then grab a mule by its head and a guy on his tail and push and pull the mules across these slabs and then reload them. It was a long ordeal. There was he describes a famous story of little Barney, who was one of the mules who went off a cliff. They're going along, and he got excited, and off he went. How he didn't pull the other mules off, I don't know.
Oh, because they were tied together.
Tied together. Usually, maybe right? they untied him for that for that contingency. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the packer and this guy who wrote this ran to the cliff. He says that the packer, in explosive language, declared that little Barney was hung up in a snag halfway down, and his pack saddle had caught a snag on the way down and was hanging there.
Oh my gosh.
And he described, of course, Barney was pretty excited about this whole thing. Was thrashing around. The snag broke, and little Barney fell 40 more feet to the ground, hit a rock on the way down.
Oh.
He was on a ledge. They couldn't get to him. Although Brayton described crawling down to the rocks. He mentioned they were both amazed to see Barney stand up and shake himself off that he had survived. He went down, and a bunch of skin had been torn loose on Barney's rump, which Brayton fixed. And they had to leave him on that ledge for 3 days. They couldn't reach him, and they continued the survey. Well, 3 days later, Brayton is ordered to take the mules to Clark Fork to get provisions. They're going to run out of fuel or food. He talks about 3 days trying to get off the peaks, this would be north of Scotchman, to get down into Lightning Creek to come to Clark Fork. And in the trip, when they finally got down off the mountains, they hit the ledge where little Barney was. And he mentioned that they heard a whinnying, a bray when Barney heard the mules, and which was answered by other mules in the column. And Brent mentioned he actually teared up. There was little Barney. And so he was able to attach Barney or tie him to the train, and they took him to Clark Fork. And he looked fine, he said. He was recovering, and Brayton went to Clark Fork. And it's pretty cool because he mentions in a USGS publication, they list the line item expenses of this survey of 1899, and there's a list for $49 of provisions at the Doherty Mercantile in downtown Clark Fork.
Hmm.
And through my book research, I befriended some of the descendants of the Doherty family. They were an old pioneer family at Clark Fork. And I have a picture of 1899 of that store, which would have looked exactly the same as when Brayton purchased those supplies. And
wow.
And he mentions leaving Barney in a pasture at Clark Fork for a couple of weeks to recover. We don't know any more about Barney, whether he continued with the GSGS or somebody in Clark Fork acquired a little Barney. But Brayton mentions leaving Clark Fork, going up Lightning Creek, he had to guess now where this crew was, north of Scotchman Peak.
Ooh.
And he had to get up out of Lightning Creek up to the east in the mountains, and he finally did it. But he had to wait for two extra days in Clark Fork because the cook had demanded a reflector oven. So this is an oven you put around a fire to bake biscuits, and he had to have those. And so he got back to the crew late, and he mentions arriving, finding the crew, and a guy in the crew hollering out, "There they are!" And that the entire crew swarmed them. They'd been out of food for 2 days, and the crew swarmed the mule train and was pulling out cans and food and eating. And
so they sent Brayton by himself to Clark Fork?
He had a partner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, if something happens to him, how will they ever know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So there's a bit more of the story, which is pretty interesting, and it's famous for Lightning Creek. You may know that Lightning Creek is the wettest creek in Idaho.
But
okay. It's the wettest creek probably in the Rocky Mountains. It receives about 90 inches of rain plus snow, water equivalent, the water after you melt snow. And he mentions at one point they had good weather. This was north of this point, and they left the tents behind. And off he went. They were going to pick him up later. Well, they had a big downpour. A big storm came up. Lots of rain, which is typical Lightning Creek. And it was so wet that he mentions they had to give up eating because their plates were full of water. They had no tents. They were out in the open. They slept and woke up in a pool of water.
Oh.
And he has some quote that what the crew said of him of leaving the tents is better left imagined than written. and they continued on, and there's a picture of them crossing Callahan Creek out of Troy on a log stringer bridge that they built. And there's not a lot of detail after that point, but they finished in October in snow, and Brayton and his friend returned to school that fall. And when they finished now, so they have those monuments are still there. There are iron monuments that are on the peaks. You can still see those. There are witness trees every on north, south, east, west directions. If there was trees, they blazed the tree and scribed in the number of the monument and that it was the border survey. And there's precise in the USGS, there are precise bearings and directions from those trees to that post in case they had to reestablish it. And so, some of those are still around.
So if you want to see a witness tree, but you don't want to walk around in the mountains for days trying to find one, there is one on exhibit at the Museum of North Idaho from when they surveyed the Mullen Road. So they have a chunk of one of the original trees, and you can see the blaze on it. It's amazing.
Wow. So what they would do is, so those trees were called witness trees because they would record the precise bearing and distance from the monument to those trees so that if they had to reestablish the monument, they could do that from multiple trees, right? So, yeah, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. There are still some of those up north of Scotchman Peak. I found one witness tree. There's probably more. And I know where one's at, and I want to get there this summer and look at it again. It's still, and it's in a white bark pine, you know, and it's pretty neat when you look at that because you can put your fingers on those grooves that were inscribed in 1899 by these guys, you know.
This tree's over 125 years old.
Yeah,
now.
It's a tree that's probably 20 inches in diameter. It's remarkably straight for a white bark pine. They're normally contorted, but it's still there. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
What about the iron posts or the granite markers.
Yeah, the granite monument to the south. This is 12 miles southeast of Clark Fork up on the Coeur d'Alene Divide. If you know the High Drive, which is the mountain, the road up on top of the Coeur d'Alene where people go to pick huckleberries and elk hunt and things, it's just off that road. And I found that two summers ago. It's still out in the trees. The old pictures from 1899 have it all. It was burned off and real bare. Now it's thick. But it's still there. That's pretty cool. And the monuments are still in the mountains. And you can, and they're still there. Some of them have tilted and things because of snow, but they're all still there. And they're cool things to find.
And what kind of metal did you say they're made out of?
They're made out of iron.
Okay.
And then now they mentioned they filled those with cement, and they were 90 pounds a piece, but I suspect the ones in the mountains weren't filled with cement, so they could pack those things.
Yeah.
And they did not carry the 800-pound granite monuments through the mountains. There was one in the south, and there was one at the Clark Fork River and one at the Kootenai River crossing because they could get those by train. So that's sort of that's the story of those. It's great detail. It's great history. And I might mention a couple things to remember with that 1897 survey, because those guys triangulated 20 mountain peaks between Spokane and the eastern panhandle. And in the subsequent years, as more homesteaders would come into the area, surveyors would go to those 20 peaks, each of those points, and then survey down to the valleys and establish very accurate control points and so on and so forth. And that was really the basis for all of our modern maps and surveying that we do now.
Yeah.
So when you look at a map and or use your GPS or Onyx or call a surveyor, it's just remember there was a point when none of that was available and people had to put them on the maps for the first time.
By climbing to the top of a mountain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's wow.
Remembering.
Yeah. Huh. So the Washington-Idaho border, they gave up about a mile short of the U.S.-Canada border.
That's right.
But on the Idaho-Montana border, they made it all the way to the 49th parallel.
They did. They did.
Okay.
And over the Moye River as well, right? Wouldn't they have had to cross that? Maybe not.
Kootenai?
The Kootenai River? Yeah,
over the Kootenai for sure. I have to look at a map to make sure, see if they crossed the Moye or not. I'm not sure if they did.
Okay.
They may have.
Yeah. We know they had to cross the Clark Fork. I have a map here. Let's see. It would have been, I don't know. Looking up here. What other bodies of water would they have had to cross? It would have been, Kootenai River.
The Kootenai, and then just follow that north.
That's the harder one.
The mouth of the Moye is farther to the west, so
there, and that goes just,
north. But they had to cross Buckhorn Mountain, which is halfway between the Kootenai and Canada, and that's really big, high, rugged country up on the divide, and that was another ordeal for him. Although Brayton didn't describe a lot of the gory detail of that part of the survey.
So at that,
maybe he was worn out from writing. I don't know.
For that section, Bonner's Ferry was there at that time, so they would have gone into Bonner's maybe for provisions.
They could have got provisions at Bonner's Ferry or
possibly?
Troy, Montana.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Mm. So, and the trains existed.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, on each of those rivers.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big help for him.
Yeah, definitely.
Once the border is established, or the hypothetical border, and there's markers, but then some of this is private property. This is not all national. I mean,
that's right.
People own right up to the border.
That's right. People own on both sides.
You can own a chunk of land on both sides of the border.
I think in the valley there's farmland on both sides, and so the land pays taxes
and plays
the state
plays taxes based on pays your property taxes depending on which.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. But does it ever, I don't know, does anyone ever have to resurvey it, I guess? Has anyone to say, actually, my land is 5 feet this way? They were wrong in 1899.
The border survey itself, as far as I know it, I'm pretty sure of this, the border hasn't been resurveyed.
Yeah.
And then because of all the subsequent surveying, all the land surveying and property surveys and Forest Service surveying, and this includes land surveys for the township range lines, section corners were surveyed. There's so many control points that they don't really need to resurvey the border. Right? Mm-hmm. And so what you're seeing up there now are just the original monuments from 1899, right? And so a control point would be right on the border.
Yeah.
On somebody's property line or a section line, and surveyors can find those all over the place, right?
So yeah, so cool. Let's see. By the way, you're listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY, and Stan Myers is our guest. We're talking about the surveying and the whole process of creating borders for the state of Idaho, and looking at the Idaho Panhandle and figuring out how they drew those straight lines north and south from the Canadian border that define where we sit right now. Let's see. What other important questions did we have for Stan before our time runs out? We have a few minutes left here in the show. Any further stories that you want to make sure you get in before we run out of time, Stan?
I think we covered the established and surveying the lines. There's sort of some interesting history on the transition from territories to states in Idaho, Montana, and Northwest, and I can explain that.
How does after we've drawn the borders, how does it turn into a state?
Yeah, and so this is interesting. I have to dive into the political situation at the Civil War and shortly after. So, and I've got to mention our two beloved political parties. I'm making no comparisons whatsoever to today's parties. it boiled down to during the Civil War and shortly after, the Democrat Party was the party of the South and the Republican Party was the party of the North. That was the Mason-Dixon line, and that was night and day. And neither party, of course, wanted this admission of a state to statehood was extremely political. I mean, we think politics are divided now. It was a million times worse then. And neither party wanted the other party to get a state and get more control in the U.S. Congress without a state of their own. And prior to the Civil War, they were sort of admitted in pairs. The Senate did a pretty good job of admitting a Republican state and a Democrat state. You know, so everything changed at the Civil War. And for 23 years, from 1865 to 1888, there were only three states admitted to the Union, Nebraska, Colorado, and Nevada, and with no pairs, because Congress was pretty much deadlocked. Neither party could get control of the two houses of Congress and the presidency. In 1888, Benjamin Harrison, a Republican, took control of the presidency, or was elected, and the Republicans swept control of both the House and the Senate. And it's interesting, in the first 2 years, 1889 and 1890, six states were admitted to the Union. North and South Dakota, Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Utah. And there were six Republican states. Washington was a Republican state at the time. And with no Democrat states to balance that. And that's how we acquired our statehood.
Yeah. Just a big push to get more control of Congress, ultimately.
It was all about more representatives and senators in Congress, so statehood. But that's how Idaho made statehood in 1890.
Yeah.
As part of that group of six states.
So it was actually a state before the Idaho-Montana border was officially surveyed.
That's right. And in fact, that's a good point. But, you know, we had a border on a map. We didn't have a border on the ground. And I might add that Idaho border between Idaho and Montana, our little part of it, the straight line, was finished in 1899. The rest of that border, and the whole border is like 738 miles long down to Wyoming. The rest of that border wasn't surveyed until 1904.
Okay.
And they started at that point south of Clark Fork and went south. And we existed happily along as states without that border being marked.
Well, right. Rough territory.
Yeah.
Was that when they were drawing that border, or either the borders we're talking about already, were there any kind of forces trying to say, like, actually, I think that survey marker should be about 3 miles that away, on the other side of that that nice looking piece of property there.
And that's there were those. I've read about those. I can't recall some of the details. And that was actually part of the myth, the border myth, and maybe parts of that were based on some true attempts. That one of the myths was that, or the story goes, that surveyors were at Lost Trail Pass north of Salmon, and a group from Montana rode up and either bribed or threatened the surveyors to go northwest instead of northeast. And whether that's based in any reality or not, I don't know. But the fact is they were told to follow this Bitterroot Divide. But yeah, I think there were games played here and there on some points.
I mean, you'd think it'd be impossible to perfectly follow the line of
that's
the divide,
right.
And it probably the divide, or it, you know, just through erosion or whatever will change over over periods of time.
That's
a little bit, you know.
Sure.
I don't know.
I suspect up in the high mountains, nobody cared a whole lot because they were in the high mountains. Mm-hmm. When it was on farmland, it would matter, right? And if there were knolls and hills and things, and maybe, I don't know, maybe a farmer went out and tried to get him to go this side, left side of the tree instead of the right side of the tree.
I poured a glass of water. I'm sure that the continental divide is over there, not over here. It flowed east. Well, anyway, it's a fascinating story. Tell us a little bit before you go about you're working on a book just about the whole history of Clark Fork. Is that kind of your subject matter?
Yeah, it's Clark Fork, but it's sort of the history of everything that's occurred in the Lightning Creek drainage, and that's how the story is part of that, because it crosses part of that line goes across Lightning Creek, and I'm writing it broad enough that it's like what we just talked about today with the history of the territories and the state. I write at that scale and work down to Lightning Creek and Clark Fork so that a reader so someone interested maybe in the Inland Northwest or Pacific Northwest history would be interested in this book rather than just maybe, 100 people at Clark Fork, right?
Yeah.
And so I did that with everything, the railroads, the Native Americans, the fur trade, the railroads, the steamboats, homesteading, the whole bit. So with all the background information, that's my goal.
Yeah.
As I'm working through.
You know how far? Do you have any kind of timeline? Any time we might expect to see this on the show?
Well, I'm 370 pages right now of just text.
Wow. Amazing.
With a whole lot of inserts, this picture and insert that picture. Uh-huh. I think I'm about 3/4 done. Okay. I've told myself I'll finish before spring.
Okay.
I've got about 3 chapters to go. I'm finishing mining right now, and then I do the early Forest Service history, and then kind of a wrap up of the Great Lightning Creek floods, because it was such a wet drainage. And it's famous for that. That sort of started this whole thing, the Lightning Creek and some of these stories. And
You mentioned that before, well off our topic here, but you called it the wettest river or the wettest creek drainage in the area. What do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, that's a great question. At the top of Lightning Creek, there's a weather station called Bear Mountain. It's an automated weather station. And it's you can log on and see as of right now, the temperature up there, the amount of snow that fell last night, it's updated every hour. And that weather station is the wettest weather station of all recorded weather stations in the state of Idaho and in the Northern Rocky Mountains. Some people speculated anywhere east of the Cascade Range. But if you Google 90 inches of precipitation, you might get that. You'll see those out down the southeast and stuff. But there's at times there's one weather station in the Clearwater River about north central Idaho that sometimes peaks gets more than 90 inches. When I say precipitation too, it's not just rain, it's rain plus what's called snow water equivalent. So it's so they have a way of calculating with the amount of snow on the ground and the amount of moisture in the snow, how much water is contained in that snow. And that can change with temperature changes, right? So so that combined is over 90 inches, which in the Rocky Mountains, you're typically talking 20 to 30 inches of
that's significantly more.
So that makes our little Lightning Creek the wettest creek in Idaho. I think it's a cool thing.
Stan Myers has been our guest. We've been talking mainly about the borders of the state of Idaho, and it's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Stan.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me in.
Yeah. Our show is called The Community Character Hour. We're here every month. Actually, every other week you can hear the program on the 2nd and the 4th, 2 Mondays of the month. Yes, it is Monday. That's right. And Hannah, before we go, anything you want to say about what's coming up at the museum? Anything people should know about?
Yeah. So we have our first free Saturday coming up on December 6th from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Admission to the museum is free, and we will also have hands-on history activities. Those are kids' programs, and this month they are going to be making Christmas ornaments, so great time to come in and make a gift for a family member or someone special. And then we're really excited on Thursday, December 18th from 4 to 6:30, we are opening a new exhibit at the Sandpoint Organic Agriculture Center. This is going to be a permanent exhibit we're installing about the history of agriculture in Bonner County. in collaboration with the Pondere Arts Council and the University of Idaho. So we will have the opportunity to exhibit some of the largest pieces in our collection, which have not been seen for a long time. And it just should just be a great show. It'll also be our holiday party. So come on out on Thursday, December 18th.
Awesome. Okay, I better make a note of that, too. That sounds great. You say that's going to be a permanent exhibit?
It will be, yes.
Oh, that's great. At the Agricultural Center.
If you haven't been, beautiful building, gorgeous facility.
Yeah.
That alone is worth the trip.
Indeed. Very exciting.
And that is the Bonner County Extension Agriculture out by Schweitzer? Or?
Yeah, it's the one just north of the Schweitzer Redborn, up on North Boyer.
That's beautiful,
For KRFY, I'll just say that tickets are still available for our Holiday Spectacular, which is coming up on December 5th. Hannah, I hope you are going to be a part of that show.
Yeah, need to get a ticket,
in
though,
some
before
form.
It sells out.
Well, you might be that. Yes, you do have to get a ticket. No, you'll get in because you'll be part of the performance.
Uh-oh.
I think. Yeah. but your friends will have to get tickets, and they better do it soon. It's December 5th at the Panada Theater. From 7 to 9 p.m., we'll be live on the air, but if you want the full experience, you should probably come down and see it in person with live musicians, live storytellers, some live radio drama and humor, and all of it sort of a winter or holiday in North Idaho theme is that's the thrust of the evening. But now we have to go. You're listening to 88.5 KRFY Pondere. This has been the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson with Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and on behalf of our good friend Heather Upton, I must say thank you to Stan Myers, local historian, for being our guest today. And it's time now for Bird Note. Time to hear about the music of black scoters.